From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Dr. Andrew Weil is more likely to prescribe herbs than drugs. He's a physician and ethnobotanist. On today's Fresh Air, Dr. Andrew Weil on natural healing. Also today, we talk with writer Hanif Qureshi. He wrote the screenplays for Sammy and Rosie Get Laid and My Beautiful Laundrette. Now he's just written his first novel. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new release featuring the late Paul Hindemith conducting his own works. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg explains why slang ain't what it used to be. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush and congressional leaders announced plans today for a bipartisan attack on the growing federal deficit. They're prepared to discuss tax increases as well as spending cuts. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said today that severe action is needed to avoid huge automatic cuts that would be triggered throughout federal programs under the Graham-Rudman budget law. Administration estimates suggest that the government may miss deficit reduction targets next fall by as much as $100 billion. The Albanian government has announced the most radical political changes since the communist state was founded in 1946. Pierre Vickery reports that the reforms come 2 days before a historic visit by United Nations Secretary General Perez de Cuellar.
The radical package of legal reforms were announced at the session of the Albanian parliament in Tirana. Internment without trial will be abolished, a right to defense lawyers established, and the justice ministry restored. Trying to flee the country and 22 other offenses will no longer be capital crimes. All Albanians will in future have the right to apply for a passport to travel abroad. The Prime Minister also indicated Albania's readiness to abandon 50 years of isolation and rejoin the international community. For National Public Radio, Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Officials in Phoenix announced today that they've served more than 24 search warrants in communities across the nation as part of an 18-month investigation into computer hacking. Laura Carlson of member station KJZZ reports.
The investigation was initiated by the U.S. Secret Service Office in Phoenix with cooperation from other federal and state officials. Authorities say they are targeting computer hackers believed to be involved in credit card fraud, theft of long-distance telephone services, and improper entry into computers. Hackers are reportedly gaining access to private records held by government agencies, banks, credit bureaus, and hospitals at a cost of millions of dollars. Gail Thackeray is an assistant Arizona attorney general who worked on the investigation.
We are experiencing a crime wave in the computer area that is just astronomical. We can't keep up.
Authorities say computer equipment seized during the investigation should lead to indictments, although at this point, no arrests have been made for computer crimes. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Carlson in Phoenix.
Hungary's parliament agreed today to consider suspending the country's membership in the Soviet-led Warsaw Pact alliance. Opposition lawmakers also pressed for negotiations leading to a permanent break with the Eastern Bloc Treaty Organization. On Wall Street today, prices were mixed at the close of the New York Stock Exchange. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell less than 1 point to close at 2,732.88. This is NPR News. Administration officials say that President Bush has offered to stop U.S. production of chemical weapons if the Soviet Union will agree on a schedule to destroy existing weapons stockpiles. Secretary of State James Baker will reportedly take the matter up with Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze when they meet next week in Moscow. The officials, who asked not to be identified, reportedly said that the president's conditions for stopping production of chemical weapons would include an agreement to quickly reduce each side's arsenal to 5,000 tons and the retention of a small stockpile, even if a world ban on poison gas production takes effect. The first signs are emerging from drought-stricken Ethiopia that the international relief effort is succeeding and may be able to help prevent mass starvation in the north of the country. But the crisis is still far from over, as Peter Biles reports from Nairobi.
Last September, aid officials began predicting a new famine in Ethiopia's northern provinces of Eritrea and Tigray. The subsequent relief effort has been badly hampered by an escalation in the continuing civil war. But according to Paul Mitchell of the United Nations World Food Program, the latest signs are more optimistic.
There have been no reports of mass starvation. There have been no reports of people moving either into the south of Ethiopia, into Sudan. Signs that would indicate that there's a problem with people not getting enough food.
But donors are being warned not to be complacent. Despite a measure of success, Ethiopia will need relief food for some time yet. For National Public Radio, I'm Peter Biles in Nairobi.
More than 900 people were reported arrested today in a wave of anti-government rioting that swept South Korea. Tens of thousands of students and other dissidents fought police in more than a dozen cities, demanding the removal of the president. Dozens of police and protesters suffered injuries in the capital, Seoul, in what authorities said was the most violent rioting in years. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dr. Andrew Weil bridges two worlds of medicine. He's a physician and medical researcher, but he's also traveled throughout the Americas and Africa collecting information on medicinal plants, alternative methods of treating disease, and drug use in other cultures. He teaches courses at the University of Arizona on alternative medicine, medical botany, and mind-body interactions. Weil is the author of several books, including a new manual for self-care titled Natural Health, Natural Medicine. His earlier books include The Natural Mind, An Investigation of Drugs and the Higher Consciousness, Health and Healing, A Survey of Alternative Medical Practices, and Chocolate to Morphine, An Analysis of the Effects and Dangers of Legal and Illegal Drugs. Weil takes a holistic approach to healing in his medical practice, and he seldom writes prescriptions for drugs. I asked him when he last used conventional medicine himself.
Ooh, that's a hard question. I was down in the Mexican tropics earlier this year visiting some rainforest Indians near the Guatemala border, and I got a strange bite from a sandfly that didn't heal, and I went to the head of infectious disease at the University of Arizona to see what that was about.
What did they tell you?
Well, they thought that I might have contracted a protozoan parasite from the bite, and I'm still awaiting the diagnosis.
So did you have to use drugs?
Not so far. Fortunately, the drugs that are available for this parasite are not that great and fairly toxic, and the parasite is quite sensitive to heat, so the treatment would be applying heat to the infected bite, which sounds better to me.
So what's your rule of thumb about when you'll see a conventional doctor for, you know, allopathic medicine?
If I have a change in my body that is out of my experience, that is, it's not within the range of my past experience of conditions that come and go and which I can treat by simple measures, I would be inclined to take it to a regular doctor for evaluation, especially if it's the kind of change that I know might be associated with something serious. I think everybody can learn to do that.
Mm-hmm. What alternatives do you like to use when you're not feeling well and you think there's an alternative cure besides using drugs?
Well, you know, the main alternative is to rely on the body's own healing powers, and that's really, I think, what sets me apart from most allopathic physicians. The emphasis in my work, both in treating myself and in treating other people, is to look for ways to gently encourage the body's own healing mechanisms to come into play. And there's all sorts of ways to do that, from changing diet to fasting to using simple kinds of supplements, herbs, gentle kinds of treatments.
Homeopathy and acupuncture are two disciplines that say that they help the body to heal itself. What do you think?
I think they can do that, and many of the traditional systems that have evolved in other cultures or at other times in history work on that principle, that they're gentle treatments designed to activate the body's own internal healing energies.
Mm-hmm. I think one problem some people have who try to turn to alternative medicine when they think that conventional medicine has let them down, that sometimes in alternative medicine, the onus is on you if you don't heal, that somehow you didn't believe enough, you didn't have enough faith, and that's why you're not getting better. Well, you know what I'm saying?
I do, and that's an unhelpful attitude. It is not helpful to be guilty about being sick or to think that you didn't get better because you somehow didn't put out enough effort. And, you know, even the term alternative medicine is misleading because it implies something that you do in place of regular medicine, and that's not what I'm arguing for. I'd much rather use the term complementary medicine. I think allopathic medicine has its place in the treatment of trauma and acute bacterial infections and medical and surgical emergencies, but I'm very discouraged by how few people rely on their own natural healing powers, and my emphasis is on what I would call natural medicine.
Did you ever have any bad experiences using drugs to cure an illness or an infection that led you away from relying on medicine?
I have had bad experiences both in treating things in myself and in using the methods that I was taught at Harvard Medical School to treat other people. I think that many of the drug treatments that are used in medicine today are much too toxic. And furthermore, they're very drastic, strong treatments that should be saved until after you have exhausted simple remedies. Many doctors jump right in with these strong, drastic treatments at the first sign of a problem without giving the body a chance to heal itself.
Can you give us an example of one of these bad experiences that you had with yourself or with a patient?
Well, I have had adverse drug reactions from pharmaceutical drugs that ranged from intolerable drowsiness and inability to concentrate and depression to skin rashes, and in patients in hospitals to death in several cases.
Death as an allergic reaction
as a direct
to the medicine?
As a direct consequence of the medicine that was administered.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Andrew Weil is my guest, and he has a new book called Natural Health, Natural Medicine. Your new book opens with some discouraging words about HMOs. I was interested to see your reaction to some of the problems you think that HMOs are helping to create.
Well, there are many. The first is that HMOs are corporate structures, and the people who run them are interested primarily in making a profit. So the rules that they lay down for how doctors deal with patients are geared toward seeing as many patients as possible. A doctor who tries to take time to ask questions and take a proper medical history is discouraged from doing so because he's then not seeing enough patients during a day. On the side of patients, I think HMOs produce bad medicine because since patients have paid in advance for medical care, they feel that they may as well take full advantage of it. And patients now go to these organizations with every minor complaint. So the idea of prepaid medical care, I think, undermines efforts at promoting self-care and teaching people to be more responsible for their own health.
On the other hand, I think for a lot of people, HMOs offer a better deal financially for their family's medical care. And, that's very important.
That's important, but the quality of medicine practiced in them is not what it could be, and an even cheaper alternative is to find out how to use natural methods more of the time, both to reduce disease risks so you don't need treatments, and natural treatments that are effective that you can apply yourself and don't involve going to a doctor at all.
Have you had a lot of people with AIDS asking you about your recommendations to strengthen the immune system?
Yes, I would say that the most people that I have been in the category of being HIV positive without symptoms yet, and they're the ones who I think have the most opportunity to affect the course of that infection. I think there are many things that can be done in such people to improve general health, to increase their vitality, and to strengthen the health of their immune system to make them more resistant or delay the onset of symptoms from infection with the virus.
What are some of your recommendations for strengthening the immune system?
There's a chapter in my book called How to Protect Your Immune System, and it contains information that many people are unaware of. The first category of recommendations is to avoid things that are harmful to the immune system. That includes many kinds of radiation and many kinds of chemicals and some pharmaceutical drugs. I think many people don't realize that cortisone and its relatives, the steroids, even the innocent kinds of steroids that you put on your skin to treat skin rashes, work by direct suppression of immunity. And even topical steroids, these creams that you can buy over the counter in the drugstore, are absorbed into the system and adversely affect the function of key organs of the immune system. So it's very important to learn what are the harmful influences on immunity and try to avoid them. And there are many dietary factors that affect immunity as well. In addition, there are things you can do in a positive way to increase the efficiency of immunity. Aerobic exercise increases the efficiency of the immune system, for example. There are some simple vitamins and supplements that protect the immune system, like beta-carotene, a water-soluble form of vitamin A, which you can get in any drugstore. There are a number of herbal supplements, especially some Chinese mushrooms, which have been used for centuries to promote resistance to stress and increase longevity, which Japanese research show increase the efficiency of the immune system and are not toxic.
My guest is Dr. Andrew Weil, and his new book is called Natural Health, Natural Medicine. In your book, you talk a lot about different foods, foods that are good for you, foods that you recommend avoiding. I'm interested in your opinion on coffee and decaffeinated coffee.
I put a lot in the book about coffee, and coffee is a strong drug. It is not a beverage. Its pharmacological action is not that different from that of cocaine and amphetamine. It is highly associated with addiction in our culture. I would estimate that 80% of coffee drinkers in this country are physically addicted to it and will have some kind of a withdrawal syndrome when they stop drinking it. Moreover, coffee, in my experience, is strongly associated with medical pathology in many people in this country, and these are symptoms and conditions which have been taken to doctors, and doctors don't recognize the association because they themselves drink coffee and have grown up in a culture that tells us that coffee is something innocent and not capable of producing symptoms. In general, anyone who has heart problems, circulatory problems, nervous system problems, insomnia, mood swings, stomach problems, intestinal problems, prostate trouble, urinary difficulties, any of these conditions are reasons not to drink coffee. If you have reason not to drink coffee, you should also not drink decaffeinated coffee, because decaffeinated coffee contains traces of caffeine, and in sensitive people, that is enough to affect them. And in addition, it has other substances in it that have pharmacological activity, which are natural components of the coffee bean. For example, the main stomach irritant in coffee is not caffeine. It's a chemical called chlorogenic acid, and that's present in the same amounts in decaffeinated coffee.
You know what I've noticed? Like, I can say, I just drink 2 cups of decaf a day, but the cups have gotten really large, you know? It's like, even when you go to, like, the coffee shop and get a cup of coffee, it's just really, even the small size is really large now.
There's some really good beverages that are imported from Europe. There are several from Germany and Switzerland that you can find in health food stores made of roasted grains. One of them has beets in it. One of them has acorns in it. There's one from California that's made from the roasted tubers of dahlias. And these are all quite good. They're much better than the things that used to be able to get in this country as coffee substitutes.
Now, you were talking about the addictive quality of coffee. Is that just the caffeine, or do you think that there's something to be concerned about if you're a decaf drinker?
I think it's primarily caffeine, but the caffeine in coffee is different from the caffeine in other caffeine beverages. It's more addictive. It's more irritating. And I think the reason for that is that these other substances present in coffee synergize or intensify the effect of the caffeine. And since those other substances are present in decaffeinated coffee, all I can say is that decaffeinated coffee is not inert. It has pharmacological activity, and it affects different people in different ways. And it would be interesting as an experiment sometime to stop drinking it and then start again and see what you can discover. There's really no substitute for that kind of experimentation. I strongly encourage all my patients to experiment with diet, with other aspects of lifestyle, to see how they can make correlations of between what they do and how they feel.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Dr. Andrew Weil. He has a new book called Natural Health, Natural Medicine. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Andrew Weil is my guest. He's a doctor and medical researcher. Throughout the 70s, he traveled around the world studying medicinal and psychoactive plants. He now teaches alternative medicine, mind-body interactions, and medical botany at the University of Arizona. He's the author of several books, including a new one called Natural Health, Natural Medicine. I know for several years you had permission from the Food and Drug Administration to import coca leaves, and I think what you were trying to find was a medically useful extract from coca leaves. Are you still involved with that experimentation?
No, I'm sorry to say, because the cocaine situation up here has gotten to such a point that it is just impossible to talk to anybody about coca. All they can see it as is the cocaine plant and the source of our problems up here. In fact, coca is quite different from cocaine. It has very tiny amounts of cocaine in it and many other substances that modify the action of cocaine. It's widely used as a remedy by Indians who have used it for thousands of years, and it has many medicinal properties that I think we could make use of, but it's become politically impossible to do that kind of research. A lesson that I draw from that, and which I've seen again and again, is that medicinal plants in their natural form have quite different activity from their active ingredients, which are isolated and refined and made available as pure white powders that can be injected into the body or taken in concentrated pills. I've been relying on botanical medicine in my practice for the past 7 or 8 years. I think for every prescription I write these days for a pharmaceutical product, I probably give out 40 or 50 for botanicals. And in the time that I've been doing that at that rate, I have not yet produced a single significant adverse reaction to any botanical that I've given a patient. I don't know any physician who could say that who uses pharmaceutical drugs. One of the great advantages of botanical medicine is its enormously increased margin of safety.
Throughout the years, you have really done a lot of research on mind-altering drugs. You've experimented on yourself. You've written extensively about it. I wonder what you make of the crack epidemic now and how you feel that connects or doesn't connect with the kind of experimentation that you've been involved with.
I think the crack epidemic is a logical consequence of the fruitless policies that we have pursued in this area for almost 100 years now. Most of the worst aspects of drug abuse that we see in our culture today are the direct products of our policies of criminal prohibition. For example, we have driven out of circulation coca leaves, which are dilute and bulky, which it's not worth anybody's time to smuggle, in favor of more and more concentrated forms of that drug to which there's an enormous profit attached. I think that a great change that's happened in recent years is that the use of crack and other illegal substances has shifted demographically very much, so that people using cocaine now are no longer middle-class people and affluent people in our culture, but the underclass in our society. And I really think that will continue. I think that's going to be an enormously difficult problem to solve until we make some fundamental changes in how we go about trying to regulate drugs in our culture.
Well, what would your critique be of the anti-drug campaign, the way it's been waged in recent years against crack?
Well, it's no different from what has been waged in the past 100 years, that our fundamental policy is basically the same, which is to try to make the drugs we don't like go out of existence, to punish users and traffickers in it, to deter people from using these substances, while at the same time being very hypocritical and dishonest about the drugs whose use we accept and encourage the use of and promote and make money off of, which is tobacco, alcohol, and the various forms of caffeine. I have written extensively about why that kind of policy cannot work. I'm strongly in favor of doing something different, and I think that in order to do something different, we have to move in three areas. The first is to begin to dismantle this whole superstructure of criminal prohibition that we've built up. I don't think that can be done overnight. I think what we should begin by doing is decriminalizing drugs for personal use, and I would start with marijuana since that's the one that involves most people, but eventually it has to be everything. Secondly, I would begin to restrict the marketing and glamorization and commercialization of all the legal drugs. That means getting all advertising for them off all media, among other things. And thirdly, I would begin really trying to educate people about the benefits and risks of drugs. I don't see any real drug education in our culture today. Drug education today is attempts to try to scare young people away from the drugs we don't like while not being honest about the drugs we do like. I think that in a climate which was not ruled by prohibition, it would be possible to use education as a tool to deter people from using crack. You know, in the same way that we have begun to make tobacco addiction unfashionable in our culture. That's a major change from even 10 years ago. And if you look back 30, 40, 50 years ago, you can see what an enormous progress we have made in changing public attitudes about tobacco smoking. I think the same thing could be done with crack.
Well, you've always been very interested yourself in the consciousness-altering aspects of certain drugs. How would you, in a drug campaign, address that?
What do you mean in a drug campaign?
Well, I mean in a drug education campaign, because what I'm saying is that you're talking about, you know, being very honest about the risks and benefits of drugs. Would you recommend a drug campaign that spoke positively on some level about the, you know, possible beneficial aspects of experimenting with mind-altering drugs?
I think you have to admit that there is a positive potential there. You know, because that's just the fact of it. You have to admit that people are and have always been fascinated with drugs because they work as tools for changing consciousness. You have to begin by admitting that human beings have some very deep-rooted fascination with changing consciousness. I think you can also talk about the advantages of learning to change consciousness in ways that don't involve drugs. I think that's fine to do, and I'm all for trying to encourage as many people as possible to satisfy their needs without using drugs. But realistically, given the nature of human beings and our culture, a lot of people are going to use drugs. And I think for them, drug education has to focus on what are intelligent ways of using them. It is not intelligent to smoke cocaine. That is much too direct and dangerous a way of introducing that powerful drug into the brain. It's also, by the way, not intelligent to smoke nicotine, which is an even stronger stimulant than cocaine. Putting strong stimulants into the brain by inhalation is associated with the highest risk of toxicity, addiction, the most stubborn forms of drug dependence. That, to me, is an aspect of what I would call real drug education. You know, if you want to use cocaine, the most intelligent way to use it is to take it in the form of the plant in your mouth. And I think that that would begin an educational unit on crack and on stimulants by talking about that fact of how you have choices as to how you introduce these substances into your system, and some are intelligent and some are not.
I think that some of the things you're saying today might strike some people as being fundamentally contradictory, that on the one hand you're recommending natural medicine, you're even trying to steer us away from decaffeinated coffee and from eating certain raw vegetables. On the other hand, you know, you're talking sympathetically about the use of certain plants for consciousness-altering functions. Do you see that as contradictory at all?
No, not at all, because first of all, that use of consciousness-altering natural substances, I can't imagine anything more natural. And a lot of my, you know, my first book called The Natural Mind that was published in 1972 was based on my researches with Indians in North and South America and studies of the use of psychoactive plants in all cultures throughout the world. That's a fundamental aspect of human life. That's just the truth of it, is that human beings have always been fascinated by those substances. I'm also very committed to meditation as a practice. I recommend that in my book. I'm strongly in favor of people learning other methods of satisfying the need to change consciousness other than drugs. But based on my research and my experience, I recognize, as I said, that there is a natural human desire to experiment, and nature gives us many things to experiment with.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your work. Thank you.
Okay.
My guest has been Andrew Weil. He's a doctor and researcher and author of several books, including a new one called Natural Health, Natural Medicine. He's also the associate director of the Division of Social Perspectives in Medicine at the University of Arizona. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, actress Pam Grier. She got her start playing tough, scantily clad women in black exploitation films such as Black Mama, White Mama, Foxy Brown, and Sheba Baby. She played a hooker in Fort Apache, the Bronx, and she's now co-starring in the new film Class of 1999. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, writer Hanif Qureshi talks with us about his part in England's growing multicultural art scene, writing the screenplays for Sammy and Rosie Get Laid and My Beautiful Laundrette. He's also written a new semi-autobiographical novel called The Buddha of Suburbia. It's about growing up in a London suburb with a Pakistani father and an English mother. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reintroduces us to composer Paul Hindemith. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg revives some forgotten slang. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush and congressional leaders today agreed to form a bipartisan group to try and reach agreement on a multi-year budget that will cut the federal deficit. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports from the White House.
The announcement followed an hour-long meeting between the president and bipartisan congressional leaders. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater conceded that the summit is necessary because the federal budget deficit will be substantially higher than what the administration predicted 2 months ago.
So while the numbers aren't clear, it does seem clear to the legislative leaders as well as the administration that severe action needs to be taken to reduce the deficit and keep the economy on a sound track.
Fitzwater rejected suggestions that the budget summit would eventually result in higher taxes. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
On Capitol Hill, the Senate Ethics Committee has expanded its case against Senator David Duenberger, finding what it calls substantial creditable evidence of financial wrongdoing, misrepresentations to the Senate, and improper administration of his blind trust. These latest charges will be included in hearings that the committee has scheduled for June 12th. Earlier this year, the committee charged Duenberger with 6 counts of rules violations in connection with a book promotion arrangement. NATO defense ministers have started to look over the Western Alliance's nuclear needs and plans in the face of radical changes in Europe. Only one of a series of top-level meetings on the subject to be held this year. Hal Jones has more on the story.
European allies have welcomed President Bush's decision not to modernize NATO's aging ground-based Lance missiles and nuclear artillery shells. But some don't think he's gone far enough. The Dutch are proposing that NATO should unilaterally get rid of its nuclear artillery now, leaving removal of Lance missiles for later negotiations. The West Germans like that idea, too. It fits in with their concern that the West should be looking for ways to strengthen Mikhail Gorbachev's position inside the Soviet Union. But there won't be any decisions made here. Nearly all the nuclear options facing NATO are potentially divisive, but none as much as the question of replacing the alliance's ground-based systems with new tactical air-to-surface missiles, or TASMs. For that reason, the ministers are trying to keep that issue in the background. For National Public Radio, this is Hal Jones in Kananaskis, Alberta.
A cyclone with winds of up to 155 miles an hour hit the southern coast of India today, killing at least 11 people and cutting off thousands of others from the rest of the country. Strong winds and high waves knocked down hundreds of huts and downed power lines. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down less than a point to close at 2,732.88 on volume of 152 million shares.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says the music of Paul Hindemith has gone a little out of favor since the German composer's death in 1963, that he's been virtually forgotten as a violist and isn't highly regarded as a conductor. But there's a new recording of Hindemith conducting Hindemith, which Lloyd says should change a few minds.
Thank you. To celebrate the 40th anniversary of the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra, the Orfeo label has released some extraordinary new compact discs of live broadcasts from the archives of that superb ensemble. One of the treasures is the great Annie Fischer playing Bartok's magical third piano concerto under the direction of Ferenc Fricsay, the brilliant conductor who died in 1963 of heart disease at the age of 48. There's Dmitri Mitropoulos conducting the Schoenberg Violin Concerto with Louis Krasner, the violinist who played it for the first time. There are superb live performances by Otto Klemperer and Clemens Krauss, and a marvelous recording of Stravinsky conducting two of his greatest ballet scores, Apollo and Jeu de Cartes, The Card Game, both of which inspired the inspired choreography of Georges Balanchine. There's also another of Balanchine's greatest ballet scores, in fact, a score he commissioned, Paul Hindemith's Theme with Four Variations, better known as the Four Temperaments. Here's Hindemith himself conducting the second variation waltz from a beautifully recorded live performance of 30 years ago with the glittering solo playing of Romanian pianist Clara Haskell. Four variations take off from the medieval idea that each individual is governed by one of the four ruling humors or temperaments: melancholic, sanguinic, which we just heard, phlegmatic, and choleric. In Balanchine's ballet, these four psychological characteristics become a kind of cosmic clockwork. The music wasn't originally intended for a ballet. In 1940, Balanchine had a little extra money from his work on Broadway and in Hollywood. He paid Hindemith $500 to compose a piece for piano and strings for a small group of musicians who occasionally came to Balanchine's home to eat dinner. Balanchine was a great cook. Then they performed new music. It's a perfect example of how Balanchine loved music for its own sake, especially contemporary music. A year later, Balanchine thought of using Hindemith's score for a ballet called The Cave of Sleep, but it was never produced. In 1946, The Four Temperaments had its world premiere at the opening of Balanchine's new company called Ballet Society, the immediate predecessor of the New York City Ballet. Hindemith's loving, beautifully shaped performance doesn't exactly reflect Balanchine's dance rhythms, but has its own compelling authenticity. Here's Melancholy trying in vain to cheer himself up. Orfeo Records dates this recording of Four Temperaments August 28, 1961. That would make Clara Haskell's performance even more extraordinary than it sounds, since she died 8 months earlier. This compact disc also includes Hindemith conducting his own Symphony in B for concert band and Alban Berg's fascinating chamber concerto for violin, piano, and 13 winds.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new recording of Hindemith conducting Hindemith on the Orfeo label. This is Fresh Air. The screenplays of Hanif Qureshi show a side of contemporary England that has seldom been explored on the screen, the lives of immigrant Pakistanis. But these aren't message movies. They're offbeat stories of love, sexual adventure, family, punk rock, and reggae. Qureshi's screenplays, My Beautiful Laundrette and Sammy and Rosie Get Laid, were both directed by Stephen Frears. Qureshi's first novel has just been published. It's called The Buddha of Suburbia, and it's a semi-autobiographical coming-of-age story about a boy growing up in the London suburbs with his Pakistani father and English mother. The opening paragraph sets the scene.
My name is Kareem Amir, and I'm an Englishman born and bred, almost. I'm often considered to be a funny kind of Englishman, a new breed, as it were, having emerged from two old histories. But I don't care. Englishman I am, though not proud of it, from the South London suburbs and going somewhere. Perhaps it is the odd mixture of continents and blood, of here and there, of belonging and not, that makes me restless and easily bored. Or perhaps it was being brought up in the suburbs that did that. Anyway, why search the inner room when it's enough to say that I was looking for trouble?
Do you think of yourself as being part of a new breed?
One of the things that's happened in Britain, I suppose, in the last 5 years is that a number of writers and musicians and painters and various kinds of artists have emerged from the immigrant communities that came to Britain in the 50s and 60s. In America in the 50s, you had writers like Roth and Bellow and so on, and later you had black women writers like Maya Angelou and the others. And I think we are now in our country beginning to discuss and to create a literature of change, of immigration, of exile. And I think it's giving new life to English writing. The prime example of this kind of hybridization, I suppose, is Salman Rushdie, whose work spans India, Pakistan, and Britain too.
Do you think that it's in any way been harder for immigrants in England than it's been historically for immigrants to America? And I ask that in the sense that there's a much longer history of immigration in America than to England. I think England has been more homogeneous until recently.
Yes, I suppose that's true. I suppose America has always seen itself as a country of immigrants, whereas I think in the 50s and 60s, when black and Asian and Indian people first started coming to Britain, I think it was a great shock to the indigenous population. And I think they always had the feeling somehow that we would go away, that we were not there for good, that we'd sort of popped in to run the underground and run the hospitals and run the buses and so on, and then perhaps we would return. And I don't think people in Britain really have come to see it as a multiracial and a multicultural place, which was why some of the things that happened around Rushdie, for example, was such a shock, because it was the first time that they were really aware of the range of religions in Britain and also the strength of religious feeling. Otherwise, in Britain, really, there is very little religion.
Well, you mentioned Salman Rushdie. Your book actually has a quote by him, and Rushdie writes, "This is exactly the novel one hoped Hanif Qureshi would write, utterly irreverent and wildly improper, but also genuinely touching and truthful and very funny indeed." Are you friends with Rushdie? And I was wondering how you or your publisher managed to get him a copy of your novel while he's been in hiding.
Well, his family and my family knew each other in Bombay many years ago in the 40s. And then our two families moved to Karachi in Pakistan in the 50s, when a lot of Muslim families went to the new country. So we've sort of known each other in some ways for a long time.
How did you get the novel to him?
I think it probably went through his agent, and the special branch pick up his mail and take it to wherever he is.
His death threat must have been especially disturbing to you, being from similar backgrounds, and I know that your films have upset a lot of people from the Indian and Pakistani communities.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's something that just came out of the blue. I think we always thought there would be some controversy around the satanic verses, but I don't think anybody ever thought that Bush and Gorbachev would be discussing it. That's something that no one could have ever anticipated. I think the main danger is that it may lead writers in the future, when they're dealing with Islam or with Muslim people in Britain or whatever, to censor their own work, and I think that's the greatest danger. I think it doesn't help anybody for a certain group or small group of people to try and draw a line around themselves and say, no, you can't write about me, you can't analyze me, you can't satirize me or debate my life or my religion. We have to live in a society where we're able to discuss everything.
We've been talking a little bit about the reaction that certain work has gotten from Muslim fundamentalists. What kind of reaction has your work gotten from your own family? I think there are people in your own family who felt that you've been showing Pakistanis in a bad light in your work.
Yes, well, it's very difficult when you're living in a media where black or Asian people or whoever are very rarely represented, or certainly in Britain when they are represented, perhaps they're shown as stereotypes or they are denigrated. Then when you do make or write a film like My Beautiful Laundrette and show Asian or Pakistani people as being gay or whatever, then there is a great, the onus on you, I suppose, from the community is to try and show black or Asian people as being nice people, as trying to show positive images of people who are generally denigrated. But of course, as a writer, it's not interesting to show people as being particularly nice. Your job is to draw a broad picture of the human character, the human personality, and to show us in our weakness, in our strength, in the way we love, and in the way we attack and hate each other.
There's a book that reprints the screenplay for Sammy and Rosie Get Laid, and in the back of the book you have your diary written during the making of the film, and you reprint some of a letter that one of your aunts wrote to you after Sammy and Rosie Got Laid came out. I'd like to just read part of that letter.
Yeah, do.
She writes, "I tried to phone you, but I believe you were in the USA boring the pants off the Americans with your pornography. Worst of all, the film was offensive to your father's distinguished family. Uncle was portrayed in a very bad light, drunk in bed with his brand of vodka and uncut toenails. This was totally uncalled for and mischievous. It only brings to light your complete lack of loyalty, integrity, and compassion. We didn't know you were a poofter. We do hope you're aware of AIDS and its dangers. If not, then a medical leaflet can be sent to you. Why, oh why, do you have to promote the widely held view of the British that all evil stems from Pakistani immigrants? Thank goodness for top-quality films like Gandhi." What did you tell her?
I haven't spoken to her since then, but I, as I say in the diary, I named one of the lesbians in the films after my aunt, which I hope pleased her. But my father and mother have been very supportive of my work over the years, although I think my father's rather nervous about The Buddha of Suburbia, which concerns a man who is not unlike him, who leaves his wife and starts having it off with a rather pretentious middle-class woman called Eva, who lives nearby. These are events which didn't actually happen and came from my imagination.
The father in your new novel is in the suburbs seen as something of an exotic because he's from another country, because he can practice unusual forms of meditation, know something about Buddhism. Was your father seen as exotic when you were growing up?
I think he was in the 40s and 50s, because at that time there were very few Indians in Britain. It wasn't really until the 60s and the 70s that the real impact of racism and hatred against Indian and Pakistani people in Britain started to affect us and our family. I think one of the things you have to do if you're a black or an Asian person in Britain, perhaps in America too, is find some way of disguising yourself or transforming yourself in order to get by. And he starts to use his colour and his accent and his knowledge of Sufism and Buddhism in order to get by, in order to make love to the women he wants to meet, and in order to get attention. And I'm quite interested in the process of transformation, in the way that the black people may or may not have to change themselves in order to get by in a society that dominates them.
You have a new screenplay in the works?
Yeah, I've got a film on the way, which I wrote in the summer, which I hope to direct in the autumn.
Are you going
to
direct it?
Yes, I gave it to my friend Stephen Frears, who did My Beautiful Laundrette and Sammy and Rosie Get Laid. Recently, as you probably know, he's been working in America and did Dangerous Liaisons.
Mm-hmm.
And has just done a new film that Martin Scorsese produced called The Grifters. So I think he's more interested in working in America and playing around with wigs and so on, rather than working in England. So I think, so he said, oh, I don't want to do this film. Why don't you do it yourself? So I said, oh, all right then. I think I might have a go.
What's it about?
It's about three people who are partly involved with drugs living in West London. And one of the kids wants to get a job in a diner for which he has to get a pair of shoes. So the real film really is it's about a pair of shoes and his attempt to get a pair of shoes.
Is this the first time you'll be doing a screenplay about people considerably younger than you?
Yeah, I do generally write about young people. It's partly because young people's lives are so unusual in a way, because their lives are not settled. It's generally the point in most of our lives where we are up for anything, where our lives are not formed or fixed. So it's always an interesting period to write about. But this particular screenplay doesn't really directly come out of my own experience. It's something that I've rather researched, though I'm ashamed to say it, because I generally hate getting out of the house and poking around into other people's lives in that sort of contrived way, but it is something I did do.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us about your writing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hanif Qureshi has been my guest. He wrote the screenplays for Sammy and Rosie Get Laid and My Beautiful Laundrette. He's just completed his first novel. It's called The Buddha of Suburbia. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. We're going to be looking at the budget summit. The Congress and the President consider what to do about the budget and the deficit and have a big meeting about it. Family leave is also under consideration by both the President and the Congress. Family leave policies exist in every industrial nation, but this one will look at what other places do and take a look at what the United States might do. We'll be paying a visit to Disneyland in Japan, to Victory Day in the USSR. And Mike Schuster has a report from Europe, a good long look at reorganizing European security.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. George V. Higgins is famous for novels like The Friends of Eddie Coyle and The Digger's Game. They deal with the denizens of the Boston underworld and their colorful language. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg has been reading Higgins' latest novel, Trust, and it's led him to reflect on the fate of underworld slang.
I recall seeing a survey once that showed that a bunch of British critics had ranked George V. Higgins among the five greatest post-war American novelists. I don't know why Higgins is a prophet with so much less honor here. It may be that Americans are no longer interested in the criminal demi-monde that Higgins writes about. Nowadays, we seem to prefer the imported genteel delinquency of P.D. James or the officially sanctioned thuggery of international spies. It's a change of taste that shows up in the language as well, in the sad decline of slang. Since Shakespeare's time, the English language and its literature have been enriched by the language of thieves, gypsies, vagabonds, and their colleagues. Dictionaries and glossaries of slang began to appear as early as the 16th century. I have an 1811 edition of Captain Gross's Dictionary of Buckish Slang and Pickpocket Eloquence as revised by a member of the Whip Club, assisted by Hellfire Dick. It lists such words as curmudgeon, cocksure, crony, bully, and slang itself, all of which eventually passed into standard usage. A lot of this language was first made popular to polite society in what the 19th century called Newgate novels, named after the prison. These were enormously popular romances about rogues and highwaymen, which were sometimes so laced with underworld slang that they required footnotes. Thackeray parodied the genre in Vanity Fair. Is that your snum? I'll gully the dag and bimble the clicky in a snuffkin. A few Victorian reformers made an effort to portray the underworld in something more like its sordid reality. Dickens wrote Oliver Twist as a kind of corrective to the Newgate novel. But the genre remained popular through the end of the century. The fascination is easy enough to understand. For the Victorians and their successors, the underworld was just what its name implied, a nether region as dark and elaborately structured as Dante's. It was the repository of all of the violent and erotic currents that respectable society couldn't acknowledge in itself, and it provided names for all the things that respectable people found literally unspeakable. There was a similar vogue for underworld language in pre-war America. Thanks to the gangster movie and the detective thriller, the voices of the yegg and the grifter were heard everywhere in the land. As Sam Spade put it in The Maltese Falcon, the cheaper the crook, the gaudier the patter. But most Americans were titillated rather than disdainful. The fashion was satirized in Bringing Up Baby, where society girl Katharine Hepburn starts spouting gangster lingo in order to convince a Connecticut constable that she's really Swinging Door Susie and escaped con.
Get wise to yourself. The heat's on, Jerry.
Jerry? Ain't his name Bone?
Well,
of course it isn't Bone.
Ah, you mean to say you don't remember Jerry the Nipper?
Jerry the Nipper? Make a note of that, Doc.
Constable, she's making all this up out of motion pictures, she sees.
But the romance of the underworld died with the notion of respectable society itself. The professional criminals are still around, of course, the working class safecrackers, con men, and car thieves that Higgins brings to life in his novels. But once the middle class cut loose, it no longer had to live vicariously through underworld language. It's true that a lot of middle-class slang still comes from the language of inner-city blacks, who have always been perceived as citizens of the underworld in the white American scheme of things. But most of it has come from the specialized lifestyles of the white middle class itself, from the language of hippies, surfers, hot-tubbers, yuppies, druggies, and hackers. The trouble is that their worlds aren't shrouded in forbidden mysteries, and their words don't evoke the salacious tingling that slang could set off in Victorian ears.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air with research assistance from Lisa McCullough, Rich Banowitz, and Lugene DeJoseph. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet actress Pam Grier, one of the stars of the black exploitation films of the 70s, like Coffee, Foxy Brown, and Scream, Blackula Scream. Also, journalist Judith Miller on how Germans and Americans remember the Holocaust. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.